Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, April 13th, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. It was on April 11th, 2009, in a public webcast just over 4 years ago, that Lyndon LaRouche first identified the dominant psychopathological flaw of President Barack Obama. In that webcast, Mr. LaRouche presented the definitive case that Mr. Obama suffers from a specific form of narcissistic disorder, which was the basis for his selection by the financial oligarchy centered around Queen Elizabeth II to become president. In particular, Mr. LaRouche identified this as the Nero syndrome, after the Roman Emperor Nero, who after nearly destroying Rome, killed himself. It's a specific form of narcissism which prevents one from recognizing that their excessive, obsessive self-love makes them a danger not only to everyone around them, but to themselves. In the 4 years which have passed since that webcast, it's become clear exactly how right Mr. LaRouche's assessment of Obama was. Since his re-election, he's embarked on an escalated course of destruction, with his strategic provocations in Asia and the Middle East, and his targeting of Russia, threatening to launch a thermonuclear World War III, while his continued pushing of hyperinflationary bailout policies to protect global financial interests, combined with a deadly austerity policy, is targeting for elimination senior citizens through cuts in Social Security and Medicare, the poor, especially children, with cuts in Medicaid, and those who are sick, with the prime example being the sequestration of funds for cancer treatment, leaving many people with cancer with no medical option for care. This is fully coordinated with the genocidal intent of the British imperial financial elite, as we see the same policy on both sides of the Atlantic, accelerating death rates in Greece, Spain, Portugal, Italy, and Cyprus, as well as in the United States. In recent comments, Mr. LaRouche has placed the highest urgency on the need to remove President Obama from office, as he did again last night in his weekly Friday webcast. This intensification of genocidal policies by Obama has caused a significant drop in his popularity, such as it is, as many who backed him for re-election, especially so-called progressives, are turning against him, specifically because of his killer policies. Joining me on the LaRouche Show today is Jeffrey Steinberg, who is well known to listeners of this program, a leading counterintelligence specialist. His writings in the EIR, his interviews on LaRouchePact.com, and his overall organizing work on Capitol Hill put him in a position to give us an in-depth strategic picture of the impeachable crimes of Obama and their dangerous implications if he's not removed, as well as a report on the shift that's occurring, which offers the promise that he could at last be removed. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Harley. How you doing?
Good. Well, let's start with the growing disenchantment with Obama among his former supporters. You speak to many individuals in Washington in positions of influence. In your assessment, are we reaching a tipping point at which impeachment or removal is a real possibility? And if not, what must be done, including by the listeners to this program, to reach that point?
I would say that we're potentially at a tipping point, but that it's going to require something more. It's going to require something more out of some leading Democratic Party political figures, a certain degree of honesty and integrity, and it's going to require an enormous amount of mobilization of the leading elements of the population, what Lyndon LaRouche refers to as the 10% really active and thinking people who care about the future, who think about their posterity, their children and grandchildren, and what kind of world they're going to inherit. The situation took a decisive turn this week because President Obama produced a budget, and it comes on top of the fact that despite a lot of political rhetoric, it's very clear that, you know, the president created the sequestration. It was a policy that was in fact developed at the White House and proposed to Congress. It was designed by people like Jack Lew, who's the current Treasury Secretary. And the whole idea was to not create an incentive for a budget deal, but to create the conditions of a killer austerity policy. And now it's followed by Obama's budget. Now, when I say it's going to require some soul searching by some leading Democrats, we know that back in April of 2009, when Mr. LaRouche publicly put out his appraisal of Obama as a dangerous, severe narcissist and an agent of the British monarchy whose policy is genocide, at that point, an enormous number of Democrats basically got scared. They resented the idea that LaRouche had made these very bold statements about the president and went running for cover. They were afraid of Obama. They were afraid of the wrath of his ego, those who had experienced up close his narcissism. And so for a long period of time, there was a tremendous degree of skepticism about LaRouche's assessment. With this combination of sequestration and the new budget, it is unmistakably the case that Obama is explicitly seeking a policy of genocide against the American people. One leading Democrat commented to a close colleague that you can't read the Obama budget without coming to the conclusion that the objective is to completely destroy Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, all of the social safety net programs that have been the causes championed by Democrats since the time of Franklin Roosevelt. So there's a psychological crisis that has been forced upon a number of leading known figures within the Democratic Party because Obama suddenly is everything that LaRouche said he was. Not only is he a narcissist, and of course, the narcissist personality has no empathy whatsoever for any other human being. It's all about his or her own ego gratification and nothing else. And if it requires mass murder to satisfy that ego, then so be it. That's what's going to happen.
Jeff, so, let me just ask you on this question of the recognition. You have on the one side the Washington Post, the New York Times, still running cover for Obama, saying this is a clever political strategy to provide cover for Democrats. But I think most Democrats see through that. But one of the things that comes up is the whole question again of the Obama health care policy, which LaRouche identified from the beginning as modeled on the Nazi genocide plan that was developed at Tiergartenstrasse 4, the T4 policy of killing the so-called useless eaters. This latest development with cutting the funds for cancer treatment, when the whole rationale for Obamacare was to provide everyone, including people with pre-existing conditions, with coverage, this has to be one of the things that really has cut into, has angered, in addition to Social Security and Medicare. But it seems to me that this makes just devastatingly clear that this is a genocidal policy.
That's exactly right. And of course, you know, when you do something that flagrantly and make not even a pretense that you're going to try to address the problem and solve it in some way, it really puts the issue on the table. The question really is whether or not certain leading figures in the Democratic Party are going to face up to the full reality of the situation. Are they prepared to basically say LaRouche was right in 2009 and that we do have a problem called the British Empire? we do have a problem that there is a faction of the international oligarchy that controls the Obama presidency through the president himself, and whose policy is the promotion of mass population reduction.
And this takes it beyond just politics as usual of how to get a political edge on the other side.
Exactly right.
Let me ask you, because this is something that Lynn made explicit again last night, this connection to the British monarchy. It's the death of Margaret Thatcher this last week gave people an opportunity to look again at the role that she played in the 80s in particular in the whole deregulation policy. But beyond that, what's been the policy recently, the indications of this genocide policy coming from London?
You had a turning point when the British failed to get their way at the Copenhagen Conference on Global Warming back, I guess it's now coming down on 2 or 3 years, I forget the exact date. From that point on, basically the British policy was, we're not going to get countries to voluntarily agree to dismantle their economies, meaning commit mass murder against their populations. It ain't going to work that way. And so they unleashed a series of actions that cumulatively have essentially activated and unleashed the four horsemen of the apocalypse. What have we seen? We've seen in the entire Eastern Mediterranean, North African region, the unleashing of a 100 years religious war involving Sunni versus Shiite Muslims. In Africa, it's taking the form of literally the revival of the tribal conflicts British manipulated that led to the Rwanda genocide of the mid-1990s. It's going on now on an even grander scale. And the British mandate to overthrow Gaddafi was key to that, because with the overthrow and murder of Gaddafi, which Obama was pivotal in, what you had was the unleashing of massive amounts of weapons going into the hands of these jihadist insurgents. This is a British, Saudi, UAE policy. And just this past few days, a well-known Middle East journalist, Robert Fisk, writing in the London Independent, revealed that President Obama had contacted the Saudis and the UAE in March of 2011 and had covertly asked them to begin providing arms to the opposition to Al-Qaeda, which we know were, for the most part, Al-Qaeda-linked radical elements. So once Gaddafi was overthrown, millions, literally millions of weapons went out onto the black market and went into the hands of these jihadists. In December of 2011, there was a meeting in Tripoli involving Tunisians, Syrians, Libyans, Saudis, Qataris, and they agreed to send a massive number of weapons and jihadi fighters into Syria to escalate the overthrow of Assad. So all of these things amount to the unleashing of a form of genocidal religious warfare of the kind that Europe went through for 150 years leading in to the Treaty of Westphalia. Mm-hmm. You have the takedown through the WTO system of food production on a worldwide scale, and Obama has led the way in that in the United States, with the way that there's been no action taken to deal with the water crisis, the water management crisis, when the NWAPA is clearly there available as a policy. So the British have been carrying out the policy to implement what Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip frequently talk about, namely the need to reduce the population of this planet from over 7 billion people down to 1. 6 billion people out of 7 billion being killed is one of the worst cases of genocide ever recorded in history.
Well, you also see it with the policies now increasingly clear in Southern Europe of the European Union.
Precisely.
The not just the theft of money. I mean, everyone's focused on the theft of money, but actually what's happening is much more devastating than that. They're eliminating the ability of people to live.
Precisely.
Cyprus, Greece, Spain, and
right, it is. It's a killer policy. It's a willful body count policy, and Obama is unambiguously in on it. Look, when leading Democrats say that the Paul Ryan budget was more humane than the Obama budget, and then Obama comes out and tries to claim that his budget was forced on him by Republicans in the Congress, the whole thing stinks to high hell, and people are, I think, finally, belatedly beginning to face up to that reality. And the question is, will people join with us in doing the one thing that will make the most monumental difference of all, namely pass Glass-Steagall through both houses of Congress with a veto-proof majority? That's what we need. That will not only solve the immediate banking crisis, but more than that, it will be the biggest transition of power away from this British oligarchical system in modern history.
Well, Jeff, last week, the documents surfaced of this FDIC Bank of England report on the bail-in, that this was obviously something that didn't get cooked up around the Cyprus case, but was actually a background policy option that had been considered for at least 2 years. When we circulated that last week in the Congress, were we getting reaction to that? Because I know we had a jump in the signers of Glass-Steagall. We are getting reaction on the state level. We now have 15 states that have Glass-Steagall resolutions. Two states, South Dakota and Maine, have passed it. Did that have an impact, or has it not yet hit people yet?
No, it definitely registered right away. And of course, we are the key factor here, because we've got to basically bring this to people in a way that they really come to understand. Not only do we have to bring them the fact of it, but we've got to bring them the explanation of what it is that this is really all about.
Right.
So yes, there's been a significant impact in terms of what we've done on this issue. And quite frankly, we're getting more and more indications sort of backdating the origins of this policy. One of the leading Democrats who we spoke with this past week, basically, who said, look, you know, I read everything you gave me, and then went and found some other things that significantly predate that. And I can tell you that effectively, this bail-in policy, this idea of looting the actual deposits of commercial banks, household deposits, deposits of small and medium-sized businesses, this was already in the works with the initial repeal of Glass-Steagall.
The larger corporations have most of their financial activity offshore, so they're not affected by it.
Exactly, and that was already prearranged with bills that were passed starting in the 1980s to basically give them a free ride to set up offshore subsidiaries, charge them massive amounts for ostensible services, and carry out the biggest tax evasion in modern history.
Well, now, on the Glass-Steagall in particular, we're now up to almost 50 signers, I think, on the House bill. But
53.
One of the leading issues is what's going to happen with the Senate. And there were several people who campaigned in this last election cycle talking about Glass-Steagall. Senator King from Maine, the new senator there, the independent. Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, a Republican, Heller from Nevada. Initially, John McCain and Democrat Maria Cantwell from Washington had a Glass-Steagall amendment to the Dodd-Frank bill, and yet the Senate so far has seen nothing, at least public, on this. So what's your assessment of what's going on with the Senate?
The British Obama strategy is to hold the line in the Senate. Basically, the House Democratic leadership, for all practical purposes, is on board with Glass-Steagall. You just look at some of the key lieutenants of Nancy Pelosi, who've been, signers on Glass-Steagall pretty early on. So the strategy is hold the line in the Senate and use the fact that there was a majority of votes in the Senate for Glass-Steagall when it was an amendment to the Dodd portion of the Dodd-Frank bill back in May of 2010. And there was such a brutal crackdown on Maria Cantwell, on Blanche Lincoln, on the people who were behind that policy.
Yeah, Lincoln had the amendment on derivatives.
Yeah, exactly. And the two things go hand in glove, very much so. So basically, what happened is that they've been simply told that the wrath of hell will come down on anybody in the Senate who goes with Glass-Steagall. And so you have a tendency among the Glass-Steagall supporters to resort to a certain degree of just flat-out cowardice and pragmatism. And so they say, well, let's come up with some bills that'll be sort of quasi-Glass-Steagall but won't pose the full threat that Glass-Steagall poses.
You're talking about the Brown-Vitter bill.
Brown-Vitter bill is a perfect example of that. There's a Bernie Sanders bill that's in the same direction. The point is that, look, these things aren't going to work unless you go for full and complete separation on the basis of the banking functions, and you completely separate commercial banking and the depository base of the commercial banks from the gambling activities of the hedge funds, of the proprietary trading desks, of the insurance and investment banking components. Unless you do that, then forget it. Nothing is going to come close to doing what's required.
We're talking to Jeffrey Steinberg today on the absolute urgency of the removal of Barack Obama and the implementation of Glass-Steagall. You know, as we're talking about this, Jeff, one of the things that comes to mind is that I was just in Vienna not that long ago meeting with economists and bankers and others. And one of the things they all said, and this just confirms a point Mr. LaRouche always makes, they all said, well, once you argued with them a little bit, that they all agreed the European Union is a bad idea, the euro won't work, and yet they would come back to the idea that they can't do anything in Europe, and it really depends on the United States. And I'd like your thoughts on that, because this is something that Lynn has said repeatedly, and I think a lot of Americans are sitting back saying they hope someone does something, and they don't realize that that someone is them.
Well, look, in Europe, there was an interesting development 2 days ago when George Soros spoke at a financial conference in Frankfurt. And, you know, I mean, Soros is a smart gambler, and he is British to the core. And so what did Soros say? Said, well, look, you know, there's two options. Either Germany accepts the fact that there must be complete banking union if the euro is to survive. And under complete banking union, it's going to be essential that Germany bites the bullet and accepts that they're going to have to pay the bills. They're going to have to bail out everything in Europe.
Yeah.
And he said, if Germany's not ready to do that, then they might as well be the first country to leave the euro. Well, I think there's some truth to that. And I think the reality of the situation right now is that the euro, first of all, it was fatally, fatally flawed from the inception. And it was either going to become a new dictatorship over Europe, a genocidal, looting dictatorship, as bad as Hitler through different methods, not under German control by any means, but under the control of Brussels, or the whole thing was going to come apart. And so this thing has been going on for, you know, we're now in the 20th year. The Maastricht Treaty was signed in 1992. So here we are 20 years into the process, and it's finished. Cyprus was a turning point. Cyprus basically made it clear that the options were very limited. Either the bailout will continue with the added factor of the bail-in, namely looting all of the savings deposited in the banks, or the whole thing's going to come unglued. Europe has been economically destroyed. Germany has been economically destroyed. A great deal of it is suicidal destruction. But the point is that Europe is doomed, and there are too many conflicting cross currents inside Germany, inside Europe, to the point that the idea that the Europeans are going to get their act together and reach a consensus to simply walk away from the euro as a bad idea whose time has run out, it ain't going to happen. Therefore, the question is, will there be action from the United States that changes the entire global situation in a way that means that Europe is free to basically follow an American lead that's not in the direction of what's referred to as the Washington Consensus or the Anglo-Saxon model?
I think from a lot of the meetings I did in Austria and Italy, that was pretty clear that people were saying if it changes in the United States, then it becomes possible in Europe.
Precisely.
Well, let me just one more question on the financial situation to go back to what we were talking about earlier. On the bail-in policy, the theft of deposits and savings, isn't this something that Congress is going to have to react to? Because this is not, as it was said, this is a template. This is not just a Cyprus-only situation. And we see with these various reports, and you say the earlier reports now are coming to light, something has to be done to shut this down. And the only thing that will do it is Glass-Steagall.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, there's a certain still naive belief that it can't happen here. And, you know, more people have died under the delusion of it can't happen here than almost anything else. So that's where we're at in this situation, where there's a belief, you know, I spoke to one person who said, well, I read Dodd-Frank. I read the language in Section 2 of Dodd-Frank, and it's really a big stretch to believe that Dodd-Frank gives the authorization for the looting of savings. But I'll tell you, the reality is that under Dodd-Frank, the first priority creditor in the event of a collapse of any of these too big to fail banks are the holders of the derivatives.
Right.
And whereas the notional value of the current outstanding derivative contracts in the U.S. banking system is $230 trillion, the the depository value that would have to be covered by the FDIC is $12 trillion. They don't have anywhere even remotely close to that as their reserve base. And under Dodd-Frank, the Treasury Department cannot come in with supplemental funds. So nobody in their right mind believes that the system can hold together. What is believed, however, is that depositors' money can be stolen to such an extent that there's no longer any reason to have any faith or confidence in the banks, especially those too big to fail banks that are involved in this process.
You know, this came up in the monthly press conference of Mario Draghi, the Goldman Sachs alum who's the head of the European Central Bank. And he said the problem with Cyprus was that it wasn't made clear beforehand that senior debt is protected, but the deposits are essentially unsecured investors.
Exactly.
Now, if a bank had a policy of saying, if you put money in this bank, we consider it unsecured investment that we can take, no one would put a penny in a bank.
That's the point. Exactly.
So the whole thing is done on the basis that nobody knows that the whole banking law has changed by these attacks going through the 80s, the 90s, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, so that banks now are largely really investment companies that are under a set of laws that protects the swindlers and speculators.
Sure. Again, I go back to 1999 with the repeal of Glass-Steagall. What it basically said is that the depository base of the commercial banks is capital that can be grabbed up by the gamblers. I mean, yep. And, you know, again, people are dismissive of the British Empire, but, you know, where was the London Whale? Where has there been every single instance of massive losses by the American and European too-big-to-fail banks? They all come out of the London offices. Why? Because in 1985, under the so-called Big Bang,
right,
Margaret Thatcher 100% deregulated the City of London to make sure that the City of London was Dodge City and that anybody who wanted to gamble would know that this was the place to go first among everything else. There's no difference between the City of London and the notorious offshore financial centers, from Cayman Islands to the Dutch Antilles to the Guernsey and Jersey Islands right off the coast of England.
And that's the hypocrisy of saying that Cyprus had an unsupportable model with so much in deposits and so much, offering so much interest rates and protection. Well, that's the whole British system.
The decision was made to take a policy that was lying dormant since 1999, since the repeal of Glass-Steagall in the U.S., and to take that policy and go public with it, and to do it in a controlled way, literally, you know, physically an island, and to basically get the debate going. Look how this whole thing went in Cyprus. They initially negotiated a deal from the Troika that didn't even protect the insured deposits, the 100,000 euro per account, didn't even protect that. And so the Cypriot Parliament unanimously rejected it. And what did they do? They came in back with the same deal that said, okay, 100,000 euro, the little guy will be protected, but the rest of it goes forward. It was a classic Tavistock kind of operation. You create a monster, and then you offer a monster with a few teeth removed, and it looks better by comparison.
Jeff, what I'd like to do now is move to the strategic World War III threats. In particular, one that's, if you only have the media to go by, it's very confusing what's happening in North Korea. But I think what Lyndon LaRouche has emphasized is that this has to be seen as part of the British global showdown policy, using the instability of North Korea as a weapon of total destabilization combined with the so-called Asia pivot. Why don't you give us a sense of what's really going on with this situation? Again, yesterday there was this little furor created over the statement allegedly from the Defense Intelligence Agency that North Korea could launch nuclear missiles, but it probably wouldn't reliably be able to create any great damage. What's actually going on both on the Korean Peninsula, and then what's the real intent, the broader picture?
Again, I think you've got to start from 7 billion plus people alive today and the British policy of reducing that population to below 1 billion. Now, there's two ways to go about doing that. If you create the conditions for a nuclear war, then the whole game is up in about 90 minutes. But of course, under the conditions of a nuclear war, the British don't survive any more than anybody else does. So you've got this pattern of escalation of war and conflict that could very well get completely out of control. You know, in the Korean Peninsula, do you get to a situation quickly where you wind up with a general thermonuclear war involving the United States, Russia, and China? If that's the case, then humanity is finished. There's nothing left. Nobody in their right mind has any delusions about surviving a general thermonuclear war. We've got Ohio-class submarines armed with nuclear weapons floating around in the waters right off of the coast of Korea now, around this whole big game that's playing out. But I think you've got to look at the situation in North Korea from the standpoint of where have we been going in the last 20 years or more? What's the message from Iraq? Iraq did not have a nuclear weapons program after the early 1990s, when Operation Desert Storm happened in 1991. Much of the military capability of Iraq was destroyed then. And we now know 100% that they never resumed those programs afterwards. There was no nuclear weapons program in Iraq after 1991. What happened to Saddam Hussein? He was brought down and summarily executed. What happened with Gaddafi? Gaddafi was supposedly the darling of the British and even of the U.S.
Yeah, the Tony Blair deal that was made with him.
Right, for having abandoned his WMD. Where's Gaddafi today? So any country, whether it's North Korea or Iran, thinking about what it's going to take to survive once you've been put on the axis of evil enemies list, will conclude that the only countries that are exempted from radical regime change measures, whether it's murderous sanctions that commit genocide against your population, or whether it's something like a full-blown invasion, military operation, as we saw in Iraq and in Libya. The only defense you've got against this monstrous power is to go for a nuclear weapon. So on the one hand, you can say it's destabilizing. On the other hand, you can say it's pretty damn well understandable why a country like North Korea would want to be able to be forcing their way into the nuclear club. They look at the case of Pakistan and India, and, you know, they said, well, these countries forced their way. They beat down the door and got into the nuclear club that was previously a very restricted club of five members, the permanent Security Council members. China later got their nuclear weapons among that five. Germany still doesn't have them. So, you know, the point is that this is the way you survive. And so it's understandable. It's dangerous as hell, but it's understandable. It also tells you that the world would have been a completely different place if the Soviet leadership had not been under British control and had accepted Ronald Reagan's 1983 offer of the joint development of a global defense against offensive nuclear weapons. Had that happened, you would have been in a situation where no country would have had any incentive to seek nuclear weapons because the costs of a defense against them, a global defense, anchored in the United States and Russia, would have made it impossible. So, you know, we're in a world in which nuclear war is a potential reality 20 years after the end of the Cold War. This is insane, but that's the world we're living in. The North Asia situation, you know, Mr. LaRouche had some fascinating things to say about what Japan is doing.
Yeah, that was the other obvious question, that Japan is in the crosshairs in a way, but also the whole so-called Asia pivot, the Japan-China war of words over islands. You know, it's clear that this is not just about some paranoid North Korean leader.
No, exactly. Japan is being lured back into the British trap that they've been largely stuck in for much of the last over 100 years, really going back to the 1890s, you had an American system faction inside the Meiji court. E. Pesheim Smith was the most well-known figure in that. And through assassinations, through other brutal measures, that American presence was eliminated and replaced by a British manipulation of Japan. You had Japan going to war against Russia and Japan going to war against China in the early years of the 20th century. And during the 1920s, after World War I, the U.S. General Staff had a war plan called War Plan Orange, which anticipated a war between the United States on the one side and an alliance of Britain and Japan on the other. So Japan has been stuck. And you talk to Japanese officials, and they're very, you know, clear that the policies that they're adopting are not by choice, but that they've been basically forced into it.
Besides the defense question, where they're talking now about rearming Japan, isn't that the same situation with Japan going with their own
totally
radical extreme version of quantitative easing?
Yeah, exactly. What they're basically saying is that the European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, have been carrying out this nonstop policy of quantitative easing, which is a banker's term for hyperinflation. And so what happens? The Japanese yen is artificially inflated against its, you know, legitimate value. It's damaging Japanese exports. And so there's a natural tendency to say, well, let's do something that's a kind of a counter shock to kind of get ourselves back in a position where the yen is properly valued against the other major currencies, the dollar and the euro in particular. And on the basis of that, we can resume our rightful share of global export markets. Of course, the whole damn thing from top to bottom is a trap. And so the difference between intention and consequences may be of interest to psychiatrists. But in the real world, in terms of the consequences of their actions, it doesn't mean a damn thing. They're walking into a trap. And furthermore, you know, there's a certain illusion that Japan is somewhat exempted from global forces, because right now, almost all of the holdings of Japanese government bonds are held by Japanese investors. So the idea that somehow or other, you know, international manipulation and things like that doesn't carry the same weight is just not the case.
Well, Jeff, you mentioned a few minutes ago the 1983 Reagan SDI policy, which was largely crafted by Lyndon LaRouche. I know you were very much involved in that, and the policy was sabotaged by British agent Yuri Andropov and then Gorbachev. But this weekend in Europe, there's a conference, a Schiller Institute conference, where Mr. LaRouche is a participant, where the whole question of the Russian initiative today around the strategic defense of Earth is a central feature of the discussion. It's clear that the Russians have adopted in full the conception that Lyndon LaRouche had back in the late 70s, early 80s. Now, one of the things that I still haven't quite figured out yet, the implications of it, and maybe it's just because they're not so evident, it was announced a few weeks ago that the U.S. was not going to the final stage of the anti-ballistic missile deployment in Poland and Romania. And I'm just wondering, is there a rethinking going on, or is it just that that was the shift to Asia has taken precedence, or how do you read what's going on, both in terms of the more sane military responses to the Russian initiative compared to the insane Obama rejection?
Remember that there's a war avoidance faction inside the U.S. military that is not enthusiastic about this European ABM. There's a whole grouping that is basically saying, hey, look, this is provocative. When you create a missile defense system that's based on a premise of we versus they, and, you know, this is the Obama policy.
And there's no way around that, as the Russians keep pointing out.
Right. When you start saying we have a missile defense system to protect ourselves and our allies, then what's the implication of that? The implication of that is that there's a they, another side. And so the cancellation of the fourth phase of this European ABM system was intended to basically create some breathing room to try to negotiate a fundamentally different agreement with the Russians. You had this group called the Euro-Atlantic Security Initiative, made up of some leading foreign policy and military people from Russia.
Sam Nunn grouping?
Yeah, exactly. Igor Ivanov, Sam Nunn. It involves the U.S., Europe, principally Germany, and Russia. And so these discussions have been going on for some time. And there's no doubt in my mind that General Dempsey, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, when he goes to Moscow next month, would like to work out an agreement with his Russian counterpart to basically reestablish a fully integrated single joint defense program. The model on the table is precisely Reagan and LaRouche's and Teller's original 1983 SDI. That's the only thing that works that is not ultimately, at some point sooner or later, an actual provocation for nuclear war. And so the cancellation of Phase 4, which was a very high-speed intercept rocket, was done, number one, to create some breathing space for negotiations. New Secretary of Defense, Dempsey going to Russia, and secondly, three consecutive major studies by the Defense Science Board, by the National Academy of Sciences, and by the GAO, all said that the fourth generation is not working. The system doesn't function. It's got massive cost overruns. There's already a four-year delay in deployment out to 2022. So let's just cancel that. The question is, will the alternative of the original SDI be adopted? The Russians are also proposing for the upcoming G20 meeting that a priority agenda item should be strategic defense of the Earth. There's a lot of overlap of technologies between SDI and SDE, tremendous overlap, especially because we need to move on to the next frontiers of science. We need fusion. We need eventually matter-antimatter sources of energy. We need a complete revival of the space program, which brings us back to the initial point that you made, which is that another genocidal aspect of the Obama proposed budget is it wipes out the manned space program. It wipes out much of NASA's operations.
It's also now wiping out the minimal monies going into fusion and these kinds of energy dense physics approaches.
Yeah, this condemns us to be stuck on Earth to die here. So this is not a sane policy, and it's a genocidal policy, and this aspect of it is more of a long-term genocidal policy, but it doesn't change the fact that it's genocide.
It actually gets to the point that LaRouche is making about the Nero syndrome, which is that you have a president who's comfortable with the idea of a dark age,
right,
as long as he's in the center of controlling things.
As I said, the narcissist personality has no empathy for any other human being. All of mankind, everything is vectored towards satisfying their insatiable ego. And of course, that's one thing, and that's one of the reasons why he was profiled and picked up by the British. They know how these things work. But the point is that the policy is designed in London. The policy is a policy of complete genocide. So that's what's got to be ended, period. No two ways about it.
Now, Jeff, to go back to the organizing that it's going to take to do this, because I think it's clear from what you've just reviewed that we're not going to get solutions as long as Obama's in the White House. On the other hand, there are institutional networks that would embrace the solutions that LaRouche has identified, from Glass-Steagall to Strategic Defense of Earth. But up to this point, they've lacked the courage, the sense of intention that's required to make that fundamental shift.
Correct.
So it does come down to having this small grouping of individuals with that intention to make it felt. Now, one of the things we've seen in the last weeks has been an explosion of activity around Glass-Steagall in state legislatures. Does this register with people in Congress? And just as an example, one of the things that happened in just this last week is the state of North Carolina had legislation introduced by Democrats and Republicans. But in the legislation itself, going the resolution before the state house, it did identify the pivotal role of Representative Walter Jones of North Carolina as a Republican in supporting the being a co-sponsor of the CAPTOR HR 129. Do they in Washington hear it when it's discussed in legislatures like this?
They hear that louder than almost anything else. You know, we had congressional elections along with the presidential elections last year. Of all of the new elected for the first time, freshmen, members of the House of Representatives, 80% of them came into the Congress from the state legislature. There's a certain process of basically upward mobility within the two parties. And so you've got members of Congress who, because of the corruption of the system, are forced to devote an enormous amount of their time to raising money for their reelection campaigns. No sooner do they get reelected than they've got to start immediately thinking about what do I do next time. In 2 years only in the House. In the Senate, it's a little bit different, but not absolutely different. And who are the people back home who are part of their persistent political machine? The elected state officials who they rely on, and who they, in most cases, they themselves come out of those state houses, state senates. So when we saw it recently when we had the Northern Virginia Conference, when a number of current sitting state legislators, Tom Jackson from Alabama comes to mind as one of the leaders. When these guys come to Washington, all they have to do is pick up the phone and they have a meeting on a moment's notice with the member of Congress in whose district they operate.
So this
is extremely important. And what we do with our citizens movement to get these state legislators activated on an issue not only of vital urgency for them, but of national importance, when those two things all come together, there's nothing more important and more useful in terms of getting Congress to act, and that includes the Senate as well as the House. So we have an activist call every Thursday evening, an East Coast call and a West Coast call. Between the two of them, there's now well over 300 people on the phone pretty much every week. And among that group, there's probably a core group of 80 or 90 who are really, in effect, full-time engaged as organizers. And the work that they're doing in the state houses is having a massive and very visible and transparent impact in Washington, D.C. It's crucial. It's a critical aspect of everything that we're doing, and the more that we throw into it, the merrier.
So for those of you listening to this program today, this is what you have to take to heart. You know, the biggest problem we have is that whole sections of the American population have been turned into victims who complain in quite a bellicose manner about all the things that are being done to them. But then when you say, well, why don't you do something about it? They say, oh, you can't win. We can't beat them. And I think this is where we see the biggest problem. The American people have turned their backs on our historic legacy of saying that we have to do what's necessary not what's easy or practical. And so this idea of going to the legislatures, going to city councils, going to elected officials, and pounding on them to do what's right, this really is, I think, an important lesson for our supporters because we're seeing the effects.
Absolutely, 100% right. And, you know, time is running out. But at the same time, as I say, all of these recent developments, the president's budget, the sequestration, the immediate profound impact it's having, these community cancer treatment centers is just the most glaring. Cuts in farm programs. All of these things are little notches that translate into lives being lost. So all of these things are creating a kind of a perfect storm moment, to use a bad cliche. But we're at a break point, and we've got to move on the basis that there is an overwhelming degree of recognition at this moment within the population that something has got to give, and they've got to play a role in making it happen.
Jeff, we're almost out of time, but there is a question that I just got that I think is a useful one. Is there anything still possible to come from the investigation into the events in Benghazi of September 11th of last year?
Very important. This has actually really gotten an enormous amount of momentum just in the last week. Congressman Frank Wolf has H.R. 36 to create a Congressional Select Committee with a 90-day mandate to get to the bottom of the Benghazi.
Mm-hmm.
Congressman Walter Jones has written a letter to Mike Rogers, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, asking him for hearings to determine that the 28 pages in the original joint House-Senate 9/11 investigation be declassified because they would show the active complicity of top officials of the Saudi government and the Saudi royal family in the original 9/11 events. Put these two things together, and you have a revolution in terms of, you know, liberating the United States from Obama and from the traps that have been set with this policy of promotion of global genocide, in which one element of it is what I described, this war of terror, this 30 years, 100 years war of genocide. So stopping this Saudi, UAE, British-led game is equal in importance to all of the other measures that we've discussed in this hour on what it's going to take to reverse the policy.
So from the question I posed to you at the beginning of the hour on are we yet at the tipping point, I think it's clear that you can see the tipping point with your inner eye. The question is doing something to get us there.
That's exactly right. It's a matter of will people, as Lynn has said for decades, will people show the moral fitness to survive?
Well, I think we'll end the program with that. I want to just encourage people to go to the website over the next couple of days, thelaRouchePact.com, because we'll be having reports coming out of this very significant conference taking place at the Schiller Institute in Europe. This is the fourth one of the recent series, which Mrs. LaRouche set up as an ongoing process, not as an event that in itself is important, but it's important as part of an organizing process. And what Jeff has just developed for you on this program in the last hour is that this process is underway, the removal of Obama, the implementation of Glass-Steagall, and that as a door opener for an incredible century of progress is in front of us. And it's up to us to go through that door. So, Jeff, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hey, it's been great, Harley. Look forward to doing it again soon.
And we'll be back next week with the LaRouche Show, Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And in the meantime, do some organizing. Let's get the job done.